Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, we are on a mission. We want to set you up for the holidays. We're calling on the experts for cooking info, gift ideas, even a new way to approach flavoring a dish. First up is our guest, Sally Schneider. Now, she's the master of superb food that's good for us. She's author of A New Way to Cook, and Sally's bringing us three easy menus and recipes for a brunch, a casual supper, and a pull-out-the-stops dinner. Beer expert Steve Beaumont talks Christmas beers, the ones only made now and perfect to leave out for Santa. Chef Gray Kunz reveals a new way to approach cooking, using the elements of taste. Dory Greenspan, a woman in love with gadgets, has great stocking stuffers. I get a chance to share some of my gift picks. And as we always do in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get rolling with Jane and Michael, the Stearns. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what's happening?
Lynn, we are in Clifton, Ohio, looking at what has to be, what is for certain, the most spectacular display of Christmas lights I have seen on any restaurant that also serves cornmeal mush.
And that's saying something.
What is this place?
Well, Clifton, Ohio is a little bit north of Cincinnati. And what they have here is, in fact, the largest water-powered grist mill in the United States. I mean, and it really works. They actually grind grain here. And from this grain, they make all kinds of flour, buckwheat, cornmeal, et cetera, et cetera. And they have a little restaurant where they serve this stuff.
They serve pancakes made out of it.
Well, the thing to eat here, if you want bread stuff other than buckwheat cakes or cornmeal cakes or banana walnut cakes or oat bran honey cakes, is a biscuit. They make biscuits here that are almost as big as a softball. You get a pair of these biscuits covered with maybe a pint of sausage gravy, and you will be well stoked with calories for the rest of the day.
Just 20 minutes ago when we were sitting down to eat, there was a 10-year-old boy sitting at the next table, and we could not believe he ordered a double cream gravy and double order of biscuits. And I thought there's no way that this amount of food can fit into a skinny little 10-year-old boy body. But, I mean, he licked the plates clean. So, you know, obviously in Ohio people have great appetites.
What a great idea, though, to be at the source. This sounds like Santa Claus does sustainable agriculture.
Well, they take Christmas very seriously here. The waterfall that powers the grist mill is a spectacular waterfall 365 days a year. Starting right after Thanksgiving, they actually put 2.5 million lights on and around the waterfall so that as dusk falls, this place lights up beyond anything I have ever seen at Christmas time.
So that's the glow in the sky that we see when we're flying from someplace like California to New York and we look down?
Yeah, really. It's like the northern lights of Ohio. But it's just, it is so beautiful. The mill is so picture perfect and picturesque. It looks like something out of a corny calendar art painting, but with the Christmas lights on it, it just transforms into this spectacular, I've never seen anything like it before.
Do they do anything else other than farinaceous products?
Well, for children and we adults who find such things amusing, they actually have a Santa Claus who, like, plops down the chimney every half hour on the half hour.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, this is wonderful.
And if he's loaded up with the sausage gravy and the big biscuits, he is seriously plopping down the chimney.
So the name of the place again?
The name of the place is Clifton Mill in Clifton, Ohio. And I cannot recommend the cornmeal mush too highly. It's a wonderful breakfast.
You can also buy it to go in little bags. Put in your suitcase and take it home. That's what we plan on doing.
This is a great way to celebrate the holidays. Hey, happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Set your troubles by the door. When you leave, there'll be no more. Welcome here, welcome here. All be together and be of good cheer. Welcome here, welcome here. All be together and be of good cheer.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Steve Beaumont is a beer expert who's always coming up with something unexpected. He reports his finds on his website, in his books like The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, and here on The Splendid Table. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you.
Nice to be back, Lynn.
Steve, I got a challenge for you. What three beers should we have for Santa Claus this year?
Well, you know, I happen to know that Santa is a beer drinker.
Well, of course he is.
I picked out three that I think would particularly please him if he found them sitting on the nightstand when he came by on Christmas Eve. One of them's probably the original Christmas beer in the United States. It's from Anchor Brewing. It's called Our Special Ale. Because when they brought this out, they weren't allowed to say anything about Christmas or Santa Claus on the label. So they just put a tree on the label, and they just called it Our Special Ale. The tree is different every year. It's a seasonal beer. It's released on Thanksgiving Day, and then it lasts into January, maybe. So it's not specifically a Christmas beer, but it's a wonderful surprise each year because it's different every year. They use different spices, they use different malts, they use different hops. They come up with a completely new formulation every year.
This is great. So, and it just has this short life, so you've got to drink it then.
It comes out. You can't age it. It has enough strength and character to age nicely. But as far as buying it, you got to act quickly because It flies out of the stores.
All right, number two.
Well, number two is actually named after the man himself. It's called Semiklaus, which is the Swiss term for St. Nicholas. And this was originally a Swiss beer made by the brewery called Herlemann. Well, Herlemann was bought by another beer called Feldschlossen, and Feldschlossen was in turn bought by Carlsberg. And Semiklaus was discontinued, which was a great loss in the beer world because this is a spectacular lager, 14% alcohol, not to be trifled with. Very dark, relatively dry for a strong beer, and full of these wonderful dark chocolate flavors. Recently, this was picked up by an Austrian brewery that has a relationship going back quite a number of years with the original Herlemann. So they're brewing the beer under license in Austria now, and it's once again available in the United States. And it's called Semiklaus. It's still 14% alcohol. It's still wonderful with chocolate desserts, and a really great bet for a nightcap.
Okay, what's the last one?
The last one is an English ale, and this is probably the least strong. I won't say the weakest, but the least strong of the three. It comes in about 6.5% alcohol, and it's an English ale. They call their winter beers winter warmers in England, and this one is from the Sam Smith Brewery up in Yorkshire, and it's called Winter Welcome. And it comes adorned with a different label each year. Same beer, but a different label. And it's got a really nice complexity, full of malty flavors. Sam Smith beers tend to have a slight kind of minerally character to them, which in this particular instance works really well with the flavors of the beer. And this is a terrific all-round food beer. This is good with a roast beef. This is good with a leg of lamb. This is good with a vegetarian casserole.
Well, Steve, I hope Santa is as good to you as you are to him. Thank you.
Cheers.
Hang up your pretty little stocking. Turn down your light. Santa Claus will be coming down to your
Steve Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. You can find Steve's picks of beers for Santa on our website, splendidtable.org. I've been thinking about gifts for cooks. You know, the kinds of things they may not buy for themselves. Here's my little list. First, really aromatic black peppercorns. You can do a peppercorn wardrobe, two different kinds. A bag of Telecherry peppercorns that are fruity and spicy, and a bag of mellow Malabars. They're easy to get almost anywhere. Another idea. Since we're talking about multiples, how about giving a chocolate tasting? Now, I know you're going to think this is a little silly, but the newest thing in chocolate is chocolate made from single cocoa beans. Valrhona has three of them, and the way you can tell is part of the name uses the words Grand Cru. And you can find them in specialty stores and kitchen shops. How about the French answer to balsamic vinegar? It's a tart, sweet cider vinegar, and it's called, excuse my French, bouquet de pomme au cidre. You can tell the cook that you can use it any way you'd use balsamic vinegar, including drizzled over a cheddar cheese or on vanilla ice cream. Finally, I've got two books that have been overlooked by the press. One's a book for the chocolate fiend who enjoys a different take on the subject. It's called The New Taste of Chocolate by Maricel Priscia. Now, this is a real insider's book. She grew up in a family that raises cocoa, and there's history, there's recipes, there's technical information like how to taste chocolate and how to temper it, and even a breakdown of how each different cocoa bean tastes. Now, for the sometime cook, take a look at Off the Shelf, Cooking from the Pantry by Donna Hay. For my money, this is one of the best real-world, day-to-day cookbooks I've seen. Donna Hay is an Australian, and she's one of the United Kingdom's hottest sellers. I think her ideas are inspired. So I hope these last-minute ideas help. All the information is on our website, splendidtable.org. While you're there, check out the Splendid Table store. Now, of course, none of the things I've mentioned are in the store, but there's lots of other good stuff. You can find that as well on our homepage. Coming up, three exceptional and doable menus for entertaining, our Gadget Queen talks stocking stuffers, and it's open lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. We have the perfect person to prep us for holiday entertaining. She's Sally Schneider. You may know her column in Food & Wine magazine. It's called Well-Being. Now she has a book, A New Way to Cook. Sally's food is modern. It's about how we like to eat, not how we should. Her recipes have style, and they happen to be healthy. Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Sally, your assignment, should you choose to accept it, is to give us some holiday menu ideas. Let's start with breakfast. What would you do for a great holiday breakfast?
My favorite breakfast for the holidays, Lynn, is a chive French toast.
Chive French toast?
Yes, it's a savory French toast. Just by taking out the sugar and adding chives, you end up with a warm, oniony bread that is to die for as a brunch or a breakfast or even a midnight snack on New Year's Eve. And I top that with a tiny bit of sour cream and some wonderful smoked salmon. And as you know, smoked salmon is always on sale during the holidays. And you only need about an ounce for a serving of French toast to really give it a wonderful flavor.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Next challenge.
Yeah?
Casual supper.
My favorite. I would do a rustic bean soup. Made with cannellini beans in the Italian tradition with a little pancetta and some carrot, celery, and onions. And the reason I do that is that a bean soup makes a great base for all kinds of embellishments. Anything from some pepperonata, a pepper stew plunked in the middle, to the simplest, which is some shaved Parmigiano cheese with a drizzle of either a great extra virgin olive oil or a flavored oil, which is one of my staple ingredients. I would have either a basil flavored oil or a rosemary oil to just drizzle over the top of each serving, which is very dramatic.
Okay, so what would you do with that bean soup? You'd have the bean soup and then you'd have all these garnishes with it?
I would have whatever garnish I could manage, from the simplest being a little shaved cheese and oil to any other thing I wanted to do, roasted tomatoes, fried artichokes, which aren't really fried, some sautéed onions or wild mushrooms. Then I would pair it with a wonderful salad, probably frisée, which is curly endive, and roasted walnuts with a sherry vinegar and balsamic dressing. A great loaf of bread, bowls of olives and little nibbles like that. And for dessert, I would serve something really homey like a gingerbread with, of course, a bowl of whipped cream. My gingerbread is made with fresh ginger, so it has a really resonant flavor, which I love.
Okay, all this sounds easy. It all sounds like I can do it ahead, and that's great.
Well, that's really important during the holidays. And the bean soup, of course, if you make extra, you can be living on it for the next few days.
That's right.
We're into survival here.
Okay, now I want to do a blowout party.
Oh, well, I love those, too. But I don't do them as often as I used to because I'm so busy. So I've devised strategies, basically by making foods that I can fall back on, that I have on hand. The first is Parmesan crisps, which I serve with drinks or white wine or champagne if I have it. Mm-hmm. These are paper-thin wafers, basically of grated Parmesan cheese and a little pepper stabilized with a little flour. I've made them by simply sprinkling the cheese without any fat into a heavy nonstick skillet. That's the trick. The nonstick skillet will do it, and the cheese melts into this lacy wafer, and then when you take them out of the pan, it hardens into this beautiful, dramatic crisp that has a lovely flavor. And people are always saying, "My God, how did you make this? This is incredible." And it's one of the easiest things I know. So it's a very dramatic effect for very little effort. You can make them way ahead. They also make a fabulous gift for people.
Okay, so you start out with some wine and the cheese crisp. Then what?
Right. Then I love lamb. There's nothing like a roast during the holidays. There's something almost symbolic about it. So a leg of lamb can be tricky when you're serving it because of the bone. So I do a boneless leg. I have the butcher butterfly it. And then I spread it with a mixture of crushed olive scented with orange peel and garlic. And I roll it up. And I've discovered that the olives tenderize the lamb from the inside. The lamb is rolled into kind of a log, which after it's roasted, it slices perfectly easily. Then I'll serve it with a port wine sauce. Now, this is one of those sauces that, again, everybody goes, oh, my God, you spent hours. Did you make a veal stock? You know, what is this? It is simply a bottle of ruby port that is boiled down with some shallots and then strained and then boiled again with a little chicken broth. And it becomes this concentrated essence. You only need a tablespoon of, or two per serving. It again lasts for about a month in the fridge. So I make up batches of it and I keep it on hand also for having a sauce with a roast chicken or even something like a robust fish like a salmon.
But what would you serve as a side dish?
My favorite is celery root and apple puree. It's a very rich, smoothly flavored, smoothly textured puree that you think has a ton of cream in it. The trick is that the celery root, which is rather watery, is cooked in milk with a little white rice. And when it's pureed, you think it's been pureed with cream. And I add a tiny bit of butter at the end, which gives it a luxurious flavor. You can make that ahead and keep it in a double boiler so you're not fussing at the last minute to serve it.
Blowout dessert. That's what we need as a finish.
All right. When the holidays are approaching, I always make huge batches of prunes and Armagnac. These are prunes that have been plumped in a vanilla-scented syrup that is then spiked with Armagnac, which is like cognac, but from Armagnac, or another kind of brandy. Less expensive ones include the Greek Metaxa and the Spanish brandies, which are very good, and even some California brandies. I keep those on hand. They are fabulous. By the way, if you can't sleep in the middle of the night, you just pop one of those in your mouth. But as a dessert, here's what I do. I put a few in a bowl with a little whipped creme fraiche and a pastry lid that I've made beforehand by taking sheets of phyllo, which I brush lightly with butter, and I crumple them like paper and put them in a ramekin and bake them. This is none of the tedious layering of phyllo dough. And you end up with this kind of beautiful, crisp, golden top that looks like a lady's hat sitting on these delicious prunes. And you eat them in a shallow soup bowl with a big spoon, and everybody is in heaven and beside themselves. Also, the prunes are the most amazing gift to give people. They last forever, and I put a little tag with instructions for eating them in the middle of the night, or accompanying something like coffee ice cream or vanilla ice cream, and I haven't known anyone who wasn't incredibly grateful for them.
You did it. Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. You can get her three menus and those recipes on our website, splendidtable.org. You know, for the hundreds of cookbooks that come out each year, there's not very much written on how taste works in cooking. I'm not talking about the scientific treatise. I'm talking about books for we sometime cooks that tell us how to build flavors in a dish. This is the kind of information that can free you from a recipe. Well, I'm happy to say that there is a new book that tackles this idea. It's called The Elements of Taste. It's co-authored by one of America's most respected chefs, Gray Kunz. Now, Gray Kunz's childhood was divided between Singapore and Switzerland. Talk about wildly diverse tastes. Gray Kunz, welcome to The Splendid Table.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Gray, you've taken this book, and in the book, you've divided tastes into these four categories. Can you explain what you've done?
It was a very difficult subject, actually, to start off with, because there is, as you had mentioned, not very much written about it, and there's a language, there's a vocabulary for wine, and when you're tasting wines, there's a whole kind of wording there that we often don't understand, And so what I tried to do is I said, you know, why isn't there anything done about taste? And so we started tasting our way through hundreds of things, and we came up with these four big categories, which are taste set, push, pull, punctuate, and platform. Now, this sounds awfully complicated, but it's not.
So, great. Give me an example of tastes that push.
Yes. The pushing tastes are basically salty, picante, and sweet. And those are the three that we came up with, which we think that when you eat, you have a pushing element that happens, meaning that you are, the flavors are being pushed forward, and what you're going to accept next is certainly something that's going to be taste that's pulled. And what it is, under pull, it can be tangy, we have spiced aromatic, we have floral herbal.
Uh-huh.
After that, we have taste that punctuate, and this is a very important category because it's like a full stop. And what we have under there is sharp and bitter. Sharp and bitter are tastes that, if you can imagine, you know, drinking a Campari or eating artichokes raw, you can imagine what that happens to your mouth. That really punctuates it, puts that bitterness onto it, that then is longing for something to come after that. And now we enter into the taste platforms. And what is that? So after you've had gone through all these complicated things that happen in your mouth and you don't really know why, you need to have something in your mouth like a mashed potato, or maybe we can also have grits or something cooked that is soft, that can mellow out everything that's happening in your mouth.
Well, Gray, you've talked about taste that push, taste that pull, taste that punctuate, and then taste platforms,
mm-hmm.
which to me it sounds as though essentially it's almost like you're composing a piece of music. You have the accents and you have subtleties. But I'd like you to give us an example of how that comes together in a recipe. And there's one that really drew me. It sounded so interesting. Pork tenderloin with bourbon mustard brine and tangy pears.
Yes.
And I was drawn to it for two reasons. A, it sounds like it tastes great. B, it looks like it's easy as all get out to do. Can you walk us through that, explaining how those four basic elements figure into the recipe?
Right. These pork tenderloin actually marinated in a brine only for an hour and a half. And then I married this once it'd been salted off. I have these tangy pears, which are cooked with vinegar and sugar. And the balancing of this whole dish came together because then I topped off each medallion of pork once it's been sauteed with a grainy mustard sauce and chives. Now, all of that together, if you could just imagine, there is definitely tangy, there is definitely salty because of the marinade. There's also crunchiness from the mustard sauce, and there's some bulby from the chive. So if you take that all together, that's how I would break this down in my language, if you don't mind.
So you've got essentially what's happening here is the brine is the push.
Yes.
And the vinegar in the pears is the pull.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the punctuation?
You know, mustard is bitter.
So is that the punctuation?
That's right. And the platform, I would say, is probably the meatiness, because there is no really mashed potato or something that's done with this recipe, but the platform, I would say, is when you bite into the meat, that mellows it down. The meat generally doesn't have, you know, inside of the meat, if you don't split it and salt it, there's really not much taste inside the medallion. It's all in the exterior. So that's what I would say would be platform, is once you break it down in your mouth and you chew the meat, that'll give you your platform.
There it is. Hey, Gray, thank you.
You're welcome.
Chef Gray Kuntz is co-author with Peter Kaminsky of The Elements of Taste. You can get Gray's recipe for pork tenderloin with bourbon mustard brine and tangy pears on our website, splendidtable.org.
We watch the children.
Dori Greenspan is an award-winning cookbook author who has a penchant for test-driving kitchen equipment. Her Tools of the Trade column appears in Bon Appetit magazine, and she visits us regularly with her finds. Dori, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Well, okay, Dori, you're our gadget queen, and if ever there was a time for little gifts,
stocking stuffers it's now. So what's on the list? What are you giving this year?
This is the time. Well, I've got a bunch of things that I really, really like. I have fallen head over heels for the Microplane zesters and graters. Microplane's a company, I've forgotten where they come from, but they made woodworking tools. And some smart person took a look at these rasps and things that cut wood and said, you know, these would be great in the kitchen. And they were absolutely right. They make graters that you can use to grate citrus zest, hard cheeses like Parmesan cheese, nutmeg, chocolate, and they're all laser sharp and absolutely fabulous. And I would be, and they're cute. Some of them are long and thin, like a woodworker's rasps. Mm-hmm. Others are kind of like a paddle. And some companies have bought the license for Microplane. So you have to look at the grater and see that it says Microplane. And then you're going to get a really, really great gift. And they're small, so you can certainly stuff them in a stocking.
Okay. What else?
What else? Well, you know, if you have a long stocking, I would suggest, what I'm thinking of is a silicone baking mat. These are fabulous. They're sometimes under the brand name of Silpat or Exopat, but they're the size of, you can get them the size of a baking sheet, a regular, you know, jelly roll pan or a full professional size sheet pan. And they are reusable just about infinitely. I think 3,000 times is the number. And they're good up to about 500 degrees, and they are totally, nothing will stick to them. You can use them for candy making. You can use them for cookies, for meringues. It's impossible for anything to stick, and they wipe clean with a sponge. They're fabulous.
So you never have to grease a pan again or do all that
stuff.
Never
have to grease a cookie sheet again. And they're kind of thick. They're like a little rubber mat, a silicone mat. And I just think they are terrific. I would roll one up and stick it in a stocking instant.
All right. Okay. Another.
Also, a kitchen timer. You know, it sounds like not much, but I don't think any kitchen should be without a timer or maybe even two. And there's some pretty fancy ones out there, digital timers that use little batteries. But I have found that the plain old wind it up until it gets to the time you want and let it tick down, one of the spring timers, is just great.
All right.
And my favorite, you ready?
Yeah.
I just think this is so swell. An insulated travel coffee mug, but it's actually a French press. You know the coffee makers where you put the coffee in and then you plunge down so that all the coffee grinds remain at the bottom and you get fresh pressed coffee?
Right.
Well, this is now being made by Bodum in an individual travel mug. It is just fabulous. It costs about $10 and it'll fit into a stocking. And the idea of having hot, just made, perfect coffee, it's terrific.
So I boil the water at the stoplight, I time it to the next stoplight, and then I push down the plunger.
Okay, I'm going to go looking for something that plugs in to boil your water in your car.
Dory, thank you, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Dory Greenspan's Tools of the Trade column appears in Bon Appetit magazine. Her latest book is Chocolate Desserts. You can find her stocking stuffer picks on the proverbial website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. And here it is. Where did eggnog get the odd name? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia query. The question was, where did eggnog get its odd name? There are two stories about how it came about. One is that the name comes from a little wooden cup called a noggin. It was used in taverns in England's East Anglia area for all kinds of drinks, including the milk punches that were popular about two centuries ago. These punches were frothy, whipped mixes of ale or sweet wine, milk, and sometimes eggs and spices. I love their names. They were called possets, flips, and syllabubs. By the mid-1800s, the name eggnog caught on, too. Now, by the way, all of these drinks led double lives. Up in the bedroom, invalids drank them for strength, with the side benefit of inebriation, while down in the dining room, healthy folk partied with them. Now, the second story about eggnog's name is how the words egg and grog came together. In England, ale was grog, and in the American colonies, rum was grog. The theory is that eggs and grog became eggnog. But in Baltimore, eggnog is a verb. In the 1800s, on New Year's Day, bachelors went eggnoggin. They called on their friends, and at each house, they toasted in the new year with eggnog. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's get right to the phones. We've got Elizabeth waiting. So, Elizabeth, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to ask you a question about fruitcake.
Uh-huh. Okay.
My mom has this really great recipe for it that we make every year. And I turned 21 this year, and I have a friend whose birthday is Christmas Day, and he's turning 21.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to know was, did you know any ways, the recipe comes with a way to put alcohol into the fruitcake, but the process takes like 4 months, and I haven't been 21 for 4 months, so I couldn't do it.
So yeah. You're saying you're going to have your first drink via the fruitcake.
Yeah, I want him to, well, somebody else is making him rum cake. All of us are trying to find foods with alcohol in it to give to him.
I hope no one's driving after this, are they?
No driving after this.
Great. Okay.
I would like to know a quicker way of doing it that's quicker than 4 months. And I don't want to just pour the alcohol onto the fruitcake because in the fruitcake I make, there's more fruit than cake. So
yeah,
I'm worried if
yeah.
I just poured the alcohol in, it would become really mushy and not tasty.
Well, the whole thing about the fruitcake for 4 months is that you're getting alcohol, obviously,
Yes. But
it's been absorbed slowly. So it really is there as a flavoring as opposed to getting the alcohol. I mean, you can buy in a kitchen equipment store a culinary injector.
Okay.
And you could inject the fruitcake into the center, but it's still going to be mushy because it needs that absorption time. You know, I would say don't try to turn this into a boozy blast of fruitcake. I'd say get some good flavored alcohol. It might be some very good rum but a small quantity of it,
you know,
or some brandy. And inject, if you have a loaf pan that's, for argument's sake, 8x4, okay, just for argument's sake. I put 5 tablespoons into that at most. It will give you the alcohol taste. It'll be delicious because otherwise it's really not going to taste very good.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
He'll get that little taste.
Yeah.
Now, there is another idea you could do, which is you could do some stewed fruit in brandy for him.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. What you can do is you can go out and buy mixed dried fruits and you can put that into a saucepan with some water and a half a cup of brandy and a little sugar and maybe even a few shots of vanilla and simmer it until the fruit's soft.
Yeah, that does sound nice.
It's lovely. It'd be delicious. And you can put it over ice cream if you feel like it or just eat it as is. Okay?
All right.
And happy 21st birthday.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye. What an interesting way to celebrate. Okay, let's see who's been waiting. We've got Scott on the line. So, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I was looking for a Christmas present for my brother, Lee, and I was going to get him a fondue set. And when I started looking, I got confused because there's so many different varieties, and I need some help.
Okay. Now, when you say a fondue set, you want him to give him a cheese fondue set or the kind that has the hot oil and you dip the meat in and you fry it?
Well, when I first started looking, I assumed there was some sort of all-purpose, but then I don't think that's true now. Right.
It gets confusing, doesn't it?
Okay.
All right. Generally, if the pot in the fondue set is metal, you can use it either way. You can use it for the hot oil or you can use it for the cheese. Between you and me, I think the hot oil is so tricky and a pain in the neck, I'd much rather eat cheese fondue anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fried meat, not a big deal. Okay, the big deal with the fondue set is this. It shouldn't sit too high on the burner because it can tip.
Not too high on the burner. Okay.
Right. So make sure the stand that the pot sits on is kind of low. And if you want to do the classic cheese fondue set, usually the pot that holds the cheese fondue is ceramic. And it kind of looks nice. And the other part of it is common sense. Can you easily dip into it? You know, is the opening to the pot wide enough that two or three or four people can be dipping into the cheese at the same time?
Okay.
So those are the guidelines.
And what about chocolate?
Chocolate you can do in that same pot.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, but when I think like they have newer ones that are like electric. Should I go electric?
Well, electric is always more control. But the original fondue pots, you know, going way back in Switzerland, you had a candle or a light under the pot because you started this thing on top of the stove, and then you just brought it over this warmer to keep it warm at the table.
Okay.
It really depends on how much you want to spend. That's really one of the great keys there.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn. Take care.
Enjoy. Bye-bye. Well, you could reach us, 800-537-5252. And we've got, let's see now, who's up? Laura's up. Hey, Laura, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about chili.
About chili?
Yeah.
Okay, what do you want to know?
Well, I've always liked to make chili, and I've always liked to eat chili.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, I really liked the chili from the can. And
Which chili?
It doesn't matter, because when I was a kid, I ate, you know, whatever the kind your mom bought for you when you were a kid. And
right.
Now I'm a vegetarian, so now I get, you know, the vegetarian organic kind of chili in the can. And there's a special taste to canned chili. And I got proof of this the other day because my son has always hated beans. I cook them for him. He won't eat them. He's five now. I got some canned chili, and he loved it.
Isn't that depressing?
I know. And
Here you are, knocking your socks off in the kitchen, and the kid looks at you and says, meh. Nah, I want the can.
He's always very polite. He says, oh, it's very good, and then he doesn't eat it. So my question is, what am I missing? What am I leaving out? Is it a cooking process? Is it some special ingredient, you know, natural flavors and small
prints? Well, you've tasted the two side by side, right?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Let's suppose a little bit here. Okay. First of all, you may be tasting the can.
Right. Now, that was one pot. Maybe it's just the metal from the can.
Yeah. And you know, basically, I think they've got canning down that we don't get a lot of that. You're tasting something being made in vats to feed thousands, so it means things aren't brown the same way or whatever. And,
right.
And if it's organic, it's probably pretty pure in terms of ingredients. But I'll tell you one thing you're tasting a lot of, probably a lot of salt. Canned food is loaded with salt. You're probably tasting a fair amount of sugar.
Okay.
And it's probably real bland because most canners, you know, don't go for heavy spicing.
Right.
And I've heard kids can have very sensitive palates to spiciness. So
mine definitely does. He doesn't like the spicy chili in the can.
No, he likes the other one, right?
And I know that they put carrots in theirs, but that I tried carrots in mine, too, to make it. I think that makes it a little sweeter.
I think what you have to do now is get a very large vat, something the size of your kitchen, you see, and dump all the ingredients in there. And then what you have to do is put it in a tin can or, you know, a lime can, and you have to process it. It's, you know, it's hard.
It might be do they pressure cook it?
Well, I think they do pressure cook it in the pan. I mean, you could try it in a pressure cooker, but this is very funny. You know, most people call the show saying, how can I make it better?
I know.
And you're saying, how can I make it worse? I love it. You know, why don't you try pressure
pressure cooking it. Why don't you try taking all the ingredients and throwing them in a pressure cooker and pressure cooking them?
Okay.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I'll see. I'll do the taste test. And see.
Yeah, nobody will eat it but your child, but the child will be happy.
Well, I'll eat it, too. I always like chili in a can, too. So.
Well, there you go. There you go. You can save yourself a lot of work. Put your effort into something else.
And then maybe I'll put it in the freezer. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
I will. Bye.
So how can I make it taste like Chef Boyardee? There is the big question. Okay, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Andrew on the phone. So, Andrew, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. My question is about beets and cooking with them and somehow keeping them from acting like the old Madras cloth would when you put it into the wash, bleeding all over everything.
Yeah.
Recently, a friend made dinner for my wife and I. It was a wonderful stir fry, spicy peanut stir fry. He spent a great deal of time preparing the ingredients, which included eggplant and tofu. He cubed beets, added them, and instantly the entire dish took on kind of a candy color. He was embarrassed. It tasted wonderful, but it didn't look like he had planned it to.
Yes, it in our house we say it turns into a traffic accident, but go ahead.
I was just wondering, is there any way you can treat beets by maybe either skinning them or soaking them in something to keep them a little more color fast?
No.
There's not.
As a matter of fact, now you can wrap them in cellophane. You know, no. The problem with a beet is it loves to share, but you can make that an asset, in the sense that you know, if you add beets to green cabbage, for instance, and pickle them together.
Yes.
Okay, you're going to get this bright purple. By the way, anything purple loves acid.
Okay.
I mean, it will intensify color if you use acid with purple cabbage, purple beets, etc.
Okay.
I bake my beets to cook them often because at least, and I bake them just taking off the top and bottom, and I skin them after I bake them because it's easier to skin them, and then I can use sort of a knife and fork to slip everything off, and I don't stain my hands.
Sure.
They taste sweeter that way. But boy, they love to share.
Yes, they do.
They really love to share. I'd say make borscht.
Yeah.
Think purple. Or cook them separately.
And add them afterwards.
Yeah. And don't do a lot of stirring.
Right.
Take it from a woman who wanted to make a beet potato salad one summer when they first came in. And also, it did not look, it was not a pretty sight, but it tasted like nothing on earth.
I like your description of a car wreck.
Yes, yeah, we have these dishes that Lynn starts out making, thinking how vibrant and gorgeous they will be, and they turn into something very different.
Well, unfortunately, that was my brother-in-law's problem.
Well,
he was,
but
he was chagrined by the time he served.
Yeah, and I know, this leads us into a philosophical discussion that I'll just briefly touch upon.
Okay.
I really think that with advertising, we have been sold on this idea of picture-perfect life. You know, we all have to weigh 104 pounds. And we all have to be under 20. We all have to have a great deal of money and drive at least like two luxurious cars. And all of our food has to look like it's going to be photographed for a magazine.
Well, sure.
And the reality is, life ain't like that.
No. And in fact, as I said, it tasted wonderful. What we did was turned off the lights, lit some candles, and looked at each other rather than at our plates.
I love it. Why not? Hey, this is a good idea.
Well, Lynn, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for calling. Goodbye,
okay.
Andrew.
Bye-bye.
See, now there's a man who deals with reality. This makes sense. Hey, you guys, if you want to talk to us, we are at 1-800-537-5252. Beth is up. So, Beth, what's happening?
Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Well, I was recently in your favorite country.
Oh, where? Italy?
And traveling between Civitavecchia to Assisi.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at a rest stop. Our guide arranged that we would stop and get off the van. And we went into this little rest stop and had cappuccino. Except one person said, I'd rather have hot chocolate. And the hot chocolate she was served was the most exquisite drink I've ever seen and sipped in my life.
Mm-hmm.
It was somewhere between hot chocolate and a wonderful pudding. It was just divine. And I thought, it's not cornstarch. You know, maybe it's egg. How do they do this? Do you know how they do that?
You are bringing back such memories. I'm in Parma. in the main square, which is all of this beautiful Parma yellow, and it's raining and it's May, and my dearest friend and I are sitting under an umbrella in the rain, you know, under at a table, and she is sipping that hot chocolate. And I have to tell you, we tried to figure this out 10 ways from Tuesday, and you're going to be shocked. You want to know what it is, right?
I have no idea.
It comes in a bag. It's instant. And what it is there is a thickener in it. And I don't know if it's arrowroot or cornstarch. That I don't remember. This was a long time ago. But the other key to it is really an instant hot chocolate, probably made with pretty good cocoa. But you know how they make it? It's the steaming hot water from the espresso machine, and then they froth it. And between little bit of thickener in the cocoa mix and that frothing, you get, I know what you mean, it coats the spoon, and it tastes like solid chocolate.
Better than.
Yes, exactly. Now, I can tell you how to make hot chocolate with solid chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is go out and buy the best Valrhona or Lindt Excellence, you know, really blow the budget on it, and literally break that up and take and melt it in a pan, and at the same time in another pan, you know, melt it in over hot water in the microwave, and heat up milk and whisk the two together. And if you were to add a little cinnamon, a vanilla, you know, a vanilla bean that you've split, and you whisk the two together, and you get a dense, luscious, rich hot chocolate.
Or go back to Italy and find
the source of this
instant powder.
The best deal. It was a time when I used to bring home the envelopes. You know, and if you ask the people, sometimes behind the bar, they'll begrudgingly show you. I got a whole song and dance about it's our special blend, and then I saw them tearing open the packet.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like Nestle's best. But do try the real hot chocolate with chocolate.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for bringing back a great memory.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. You can reach us anytime. Just call the answering machine at 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this wish from all of us. May this be a holiday filled with the people you care about, with laughter, and with peace. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You can find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.